Welcome to episode 32 of There Might Be Cupcakes. What the Dickens? This is your host, Carla, and today, on this day between the solstice and Christmas, we're going to celebrate Christmas Victorian way. No, I have not brought wassail nor nog, and no carolers abide at the door, though all those traditions were started by the Victorians. You know, with me, it's going to get a little strange in the very best way. So we're going to celebrate Yule and Christmas with my favorite Victorian tradition, scary stories. That's right, there really is a horror subgenre called Christmas horror, and it was started by the Victorians, the people we associate with fussiness about sex and strict societal strata. I know you don't believe me. You probably think I've been imbibing on bourbon cupcake icing, which is a thing, you know. But it's true, and I'll bet everyone listening knows one Victorian Christmas horror story. You do. Because the most famous of all is A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Really? Really look at it. Ghosts, ghouls, fear, terror. To quote the Goonies from my friend Brent from the Sofa King podcast, dead things, Mikey, dead things. It's been softened through familiarity, Bill Murray, and Muppets, but it really is a pretty horrific tale. If you've never read it or you're in the mood to revisit it, it's my Audible recommendation for this episode, narrated by the sublime Tim Curry. Just go to audibletrial.com/mightbecupcakes and choose it as your free book to keep when you sign up for your 30-day membership trial. Tim Curry is one of the best audiobook narrators out there, and he and Dickens' novel were made for each other. Okay. The forerunners of this horrific Christmas tradition were Dickens and M.R. James. Charles Dickens actually wrote 5 horror novels for Christmastide. A Christmas Carol in 1843, The Chimes in 1844, The Cricket on the Hearth, 1845, The Battle of Life, 1846, and The Haunted Man, 1848, plus the short story The Signal Man, 1866. A Christmas Carol was originally released in serial form in a periodical just before Christmas in 1843, which was the very same year that the first commercially produced Christmas cards were sold and sent out. M.R. James, who at the time was the provost of King's College in Cambridge, would have his servants make wassail and eggnog and would invite friends and select students of his to his rooms on Christmas Eve, where he would gather them before the fire and read to them a scary story he had written just for the occasion. These stories are all anthologized in the 2-volume set Ghost Stories of an Antiquity, and I will link to them in this episode's website entry. The following story is one of those, entitled simply, A School Story. So, close your eyes and imagine. We are in a dark, yet cozy gentleman Victorian quarters. All dark woods and velvets. The servants have stoked the fire to a pleasant blaze. It and the candles are the only illumination. The gas lights have been lowered for this occasion. Through the mullioned window frame, you can see the driving snow in the dusk. The sight is both thrilling and a little eerie. It makes you feel both warm and cozy and chilled and nervous at the same time. You're more aware of the darkness at your back and the warmth and light at your face. I, as your host, stand with my elbow on the mantel as you sit on your chosen plush settee, clutching your warm drink. Your belly is full, and it's Christmas Eve. We are all very good friends. It's time for me to read. A School Story by M.R. James. 2 men in a smoking room were talking of their private school days. At our school, said A, we had a ghost's footmark on the staircase. What was it like? Oh, very unconvincing. Just the shape of a suit. A School Story by M.R. James. 2 men in a smoking room were talking of their private school days. At our school, said A, we had a ghost's footmark on the staircase. What was it like? Oh, very unconvincing. Just the shape of a shoe with square toe, if I remember right. The staircase was a stone one. I never heard any story about the thing. And that seems odd, now that I come to think of it. Why didn't somebody invent one, I wonder? You can never tell with little boys. They have a mythology of their own. There's a subject for you, by the way. The folklore of private schools. Yes, the crop is rather scanty, though. I imagine if you were to investigate the cycle of ghost stories, for instance, which the boys at private schools tell each other, they would all turn out to be highly compressed versions of stories out of books. Nowadays, the Strand and Pearsons and so on would be extensively drawn upon, for example. No doubt. They weren't born or thought of in my time. Let's see. I wonder if I can remember the staple ones that I was told. First, there was the house with the room in it, which a series of people insisted on passing a night, and each of them in the morning was found kneeling in a corner and had just had time to say, "I've seen it," and died. Wasn't that the house on Berkeley Square? I dare say it was. Then there was the man who heard a noise in the passage at night, opened his door, and saw something crawling towards him on all fours with its eye hanging out of his cheek. Yes, and then besides, let me think. Yes, the room where a man was found dead in bed with a horseshoe mark on his forehead, and the floor under the bed was covered with marks of horseshoes also. I don't know why. Also, there was the lady who, on locking her bedroom door in a strange house, heard a thin voice among the bed curtains say, "Now we're both shut in for the night." None of those had any explanations or sequel. I wonder if they go on still, these stories. Oh, likely enough, with additions from the magazines, as I said. You never heard, did you, of a real ghost at a private school? Nah, I thought not. Nobody that has that I've ever come across. From the way you said it, I gather you have? I really don't know, but this is what was in my mind. It happened in my private school 30-odd years ago, and I haven't any explanation for it. The school that I mean was near London. It was established in a large and fairly old house, a great white building with very fine grounds about it. There were large cedars in the garden, as there are in so many of the older gardens in the Thames Valley, and ancient elms in the 3 or 4 fields which we use for our games. I think it was probably quite an attractive place, but boys seldom allow that their schools possess any tolerable features. I came to the school in September, soon after the year 1870, and among the boys who arrived on the same day was one I took to, a Highland boy, Raw Calm Cloud. I needn't spend time in describing him. The main thing is that I got to know him very well. He was not an exceptional boy in any way, not particularly good at books or games, but he suited me. The school was a large one. There must have been from 120, 130 boys there as a rule, and so a considerable staff of masters was required, and there were rather frequent changes among them. One term, perhaps it was my third, maybe my fourth, a new master made his appearance. His name was Samson. He was a tallish, stoutish, pale, black-bearded man. I think we liked him. He traveled a good deal and had stories which amused us on our school walks, so that there was some competition among us to get within earshot of him. I remember, too, oh, dear me, I'd hardly thought of it since then, that he had a charm on his watch chain that attracted my attention one day, and he let me examine it. It was, I now suppose, a gold Byzantine coin. There was an effigy of some absurd emperor on one side. The other side had been worn practically smooth, and he had cut on it, rather barbarously, his own initials, GWS, and a date, 24 July 1865. Yes, I can see it now. He told me he'd picked it up in Constantinople. It was about the size of a florin, perhaps rather smaller. Well, the first odd thing that happened was this. Samson was doing Latin grammar with us. One of his favorite methods, perhaps it's rather a good one, was to make us construct sentences out of our own heads to illustrate the rules he was trying to make us learn. Of course, that's a thing which gives a silly boy a chance of being impertinent. There are a lot of school stories in which this happens, or anywhere there should be. But Samson was too good a disciplinarian for us to think of trying that on with him. Now, on this occasion, he was telling us how to express remembering in Latin, and he ordered each of us to make a sentence beginning in the verb memem, I remember. Well, most of us made up some ordinary sentence, such as, "I remember my father," or "He remembers this book," or something equally uninteresting, and I dare say a good many put down mememo librum mum, my book belongs to me, and so forth. But the boy I mentioned, McLeod, was evidently thinking of something more elaborate than that. The rest of us wanted to have our sentences passed in and get on to something else, so some kicked him under the desk, and I, who was next to him, poked him and whispered to him to look sharp. But he didn't seem to attend. I looked at his paper and saw he'd put down nothing at all. So I jogged him again harder than before and upbraided him sharply for keeping us all waiting. That did have some effect. He started and seemed to wake up, and then very quickly scribbled a couple of lines on his paper and showed it up with the rest. As it was the last, or nearly the last, to come in, and as Samson had a good deal to say to the boys who had written Mimimicus Patre Meo, I remember my father, and the rest of it, it turned out that the clock struck 12 before he got into McLeod, and McLeod had to wait afterwards to have his sentence corrected. There was nothing much going on outside when I got out, so I waited for him. He came very slowly when he did arrive, and I guess there had been some sort of trouble. Well, I said, what'd you get? Oh, I don't know, said McLeod. Nothing much, but I think Samson's rather sick with me. Why, did you show him up some rot? No fear, he said. It was all right as far as I can see. It was like this. Memento. That's right enough for remember, and it takes a genitive. Memento puti inter quattro taxos. What silly rot, I said. What made you shove that down? What does it mean? That's the funny part, said McLeod. I'm not quite sure what it does mean. All I know is it just came into my head and I corked it down. I know what I think it means. Because before I just before I wrote it down, I had sort of a picture of it in my head. I believe it means, remember the well among the four. What are those dark sort of trees that have red berries on them? Mountain ashes, I suppose you mean. I never heard of them, said McLeod. No, I'll tell you, yews. Yew trees. Well, and what did Samson say? Well, he was jolly odd about it. When he read the sentence, he got up and went to the mantelpiece and stopped quite a long time without saying anything, with his back to me. And then he said, without turning round and rather quiet, what do you suppose that means? I told him what I thought, only I couldn't remember the name of the silly tree. And then he wanted to know why I wrote it down, and I had to say something or other. And after that he left off talking about it, and he asked me how long I'd been here, and where my people lived, and things like that. And then I came away, but he wasn't looking a bit well. I don't remember any more that was said by either of us about this. Next day, McLeod took to his bed with a chill or something of the kind, and it was a week or more before he was in class again. And as much as a month went by without anything happening that was noticeable. Whether or not Mr. Samson was really startled, as McLeod had thought, he didn't show it. I'm pretty sure, of course, now, that there was something very curious in his past history. But I'm not going to pretend that we boys were sharp enough to guess any sort of thing. There was one other incident of the same kind as the last which I told you. Several times since that day we had make-up examples in school to illustrate different rules, but there had never been any row except when we did them wrong. At last there came a day when we were going through those dismal things which people call conditional sentences, and we were told to make a conditional sentence expressing a future consequence. We did it, right or wrong, and showed up our bits of paper, and Samson began looking through them. All at once he got up, made some odd sort of noise in his throat, and rushed out a door that was just by his desk. We sat there for a minute or two, and then, I suppose it was incorrect, but we went up, I and one or two others, to look at the papers on his desk. Of course I thought someone must put down some nonsense or other, and Samson had gone off to report him. All the same, I noticed he hadn't taken any of the papers with him when he ran out. Well, the top paper on the desk was written in red ink, which no one used, and it wasn't in anyone's hand who was in the class. They all looked at it, McLeod and all, and took their dying oaths it wasn't theirs. Then I thought of counting the bits of paper, and of this I made quite certain. There were 17 bits of paper on the desk, and 16 boys in the form. Well, I bagged the extra paper and I kept it. And I believe I have it now. And now you will want to know what is written on it. It was simple enough, and harmless enough, I should have said. Si tu non veritas ad me, ego venena a ti. Which means, I suppose, if you don't come to me, I'll come to you. Could you show me the paper? Interrupted the listener. Yes, I could, but that's another thing odd about it. The same afternoon I took it out of my locker. I know for certain it was the very same bit, because I made a certain finger mark on it, and no single trace of writing of any kind was there on it. I kept it, as I said, and since that time I've tried various experiments to see whether sympathetic ink had been used, but absolutely without result. So much for that. After about half an hour, Samson looked in again, said he had felt very unwell, and told us we might go. He came very gingerly to his desk and gave just one look at the uppermost paper, and I suppose he thought he must have been dreaming. Anyhow, he asked no questions. That day was a half holiday, and next day Samson was in school again, much as usual. That night, the third and last incident in my story happened. We, McLeod and I, slept in a dormitory at right angles to the main building. Samson slept in the main building on the first floor. There was a very bright full moon. At an hour, which I can't tell exactly, but sometime between 1 and 2, I was woken up by someone shaking me. It was McLeod, and a nice state of mind he seemed to be in. "Come," he said, "come. There's a burglar getting in through Samson's window." As soon as I could speak, I said, "Well, why not call out and wake everyone up?" No, he said. "I'm not sure who it is. Don't make a row. Come and look." Well, naturally, I came and looked. And naturally, there was no one there. I was cross enough, and I should have called McLeod plenty of names. Only, I couldn't tell why. It seemed to me there was something wrong. Something that made me very glad I wasn't alone to face it. We were still at the window looking out, and as soon as I could, I asked him what he'd heard or seen. "I didn't hear anything at all," he said. "But about 5 minutes before I woke you, I found myself looking out of this window here, and there was a man sitting or kneeling on Samson's windowsill. And looking in, and I thought he was beckoning." "What sort of man?" McLeod wriggled. "I don't know," he said, "but I can tell you one thing. He was beastly thin, and he looked as if he was wet all over. And," he said, looking around and whispering as if he hardly liked to hear himself, "I'm not at all sure he was alive." We went on talking in whispers some time longer and eventually crept back to bed. No one in the room woke or stirred the whole time. I believe we did sleep a bit afterwards, but we were very cheap the next day. And next day, Mr. Sampson was gone, not to be found, and I believe no trace of him has ever come to light since. In thinking it over, one of the oddest things about it all has seemed to me the fact that neither McLeod or I ever mentioned what we'd seen to any third person whatsoever. Of course, no questions were asked on the subject, and if they had been, I am inclined to believe we could not have made any answer. We seemed unable to speak about it. "That is my story," said the narrator. "The only approach to a ghost story connected with the school that I know. But still, I think, an approach to such a thing." The sequel to this may be reckoned highly conventional, but a sequel there is, and so it must be produced. There had been more than one listener to the story, and in the latter part of that same year, or of the next, one such listener was staying at a country house in Ireland. One evening his host was turning over a drawer full of odds and ends in the smoking room. Suddenly he put his hand on a little box. "Now," he said, "you know about old things. Tell me what that is." My friend opened the little box and found in it a thin gold chain with an object attached to it. He glanced at the object and then took off his spectacles to examine more narrowly. "What's the history of this?" he asked. "Odd enough," was the answer. "You know the yew thicket and the shrubbery? Where a year or two back we were cleaning out the old well that used to be in the clearing here, and what do you suppose we found?" "Is it possible you found a body?" said the visitor, with an odd feeling of nervousness. "We did that. But what's more, in every sense of the word, we found two." "Good heavens, two? Was there anything to show how they got there? Was this thing found with them?" "It was. Amongst the rags, the clothes that were on one of the bodies. A bad business, whatever the story of it may have been. One body had its arms tight round the other. They must have been there 30 years or more, long before we came to this place. You may judge we filled up the well fast enough. You make anything of what's cut on that gold coin you have there?" "I think I can," said my friend, holding it to the light, but he read it without much difficulty. "It seems to be GWS, 24 July, 1865. Many of our Christmas traditions today come from the Victorians, such as the Christmas tree as we now decorate it, and our current incarnation of a fat Santa Claus. That whole description comes directly from the poem, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. But whence comes the horror? Well, Queen Victoria's reign began in 1837, and with it came many changes that influenced this taste for horror in winter and at Christmas. First, of course, Christmas falls at Yuletide, the cusp between the darkest days and the turn towards lighter, longer days. Christmas time can be for many a time for remembering those who are no longer celebrating with us. That is true, of course, no matter what the era. But the Victorians had a certain, shall I say, special relationship with death. This period had the advent of photography, and so the fascination with post-mortem photography was born. The Society for Psychical Research was founded in 1882, and with that brought a mania for spiritualism and spiritual photography, capturing ghosts and ectoplasm on film. Plus, this was the time period of memento mori, when mourning would involve wearing jewelry made from the hair of the deceased. Death was always with the Victorians. Add to all this the uncertainty of the time. There were a lot of economic changes. This was the time of the Industrial Revolution, which led to moves from rural living to city, changing roles, changing jobs, changing fortunes, the creation of a new middle class. Then there was access to stories, the availability of the periodical. Magazines, basically, were now a thing. As I have said, A Christmas Carol was released as a serial. People could collect, exchange, and share short stories and serialized novels, and the spookier and grimmer, the better. It was never more true than in this era than if it bleeds, it leads. The working public had little money to spend on entertainment. The periodical they chose to buy with their hard-earned factory or servant money had better give them the bang for their buck. And finally, daily life was a little jumpy. Anything could be around any corner, literally. Now imagine, servants lived as silent members of households that could afford them. They were meant to be seen and not heard. And they often had their own stairways, hallways, and sometimes secret passageways to be seen as little as possible. But when they needed to be seen, they didn't announce their presence. They literally were the ghosts of the house. You could open your eyes in the morning to find your chambermaid hovering over you, tending to some household task. Imagine coming out of a nightmare to make contact with some silent person dressed in white apron and a cap making eye contact with you. Plus, homes were lit with gas, which was low lighting and unreliable. The lights would go in and out. And soot and gas streetlights made for eerie walks home at night. Life was a horror movie waiting to happen. And then it did, with Jack the Ripper in 1888. So, in that environment, if you didn't embrace the fear as fun, the fear would overwhelm you. And that's one of the main purposes of the horror genre. It helps us rehearse fight-or-flight adrenaline rushes in safety, just like roughhousing play. Other major storytelling names in this horror subgenre of Yule horror were Elizabeth Gaskell, E.F. Benson, Algernon Blackwood, Mrs. J.H. Riddle, Sir Andrew Caldecott, A.M. Burridge, Sheridan Le Fanu, Amelia B. Edwards, who was, interestingly, an Egyptologist, Charlotte Riddell, Robert Louis Stevenson, Oscar Wilde, Rudyard Kipling, and Henry James, and Saki, otherwise known as H.H. Munro. Saki is a genius when it comes to the playground of the short story. He's been compared to Dorothy Parker and O. Henry. He started writing near the end of the Victorian era, but I chose this particular story of his because it's just so playfully gleeful. It shows the other side of the subgenre. Horror is sometimes playful, you know. You know, think of the Crypt Keeper from Tales from the Crypt. So, here we go again. Close your eyes one more time for me. Now, imagine this time, it's later in the evening. We've been enervated by strong Nog and Wassail and many scary stories. The fire, as you can hear, has settled down, and the wind has picked up. It's whistling through the shaft. Someone got the bright idea to make popcorn strings and popcorn balls, and our group is merry in front of the fire, half on settees and half piled on the floor now, all buttered hands and faces, distracted and warm, inside and out, and almost through with the popcorn crafting and eating, ready for that last story for me to tell in order to send you a little frightened, but happy and laughing, out to your carriages for the cold, crisp ride home to your own Christmas. So here, one more, and a hearty wassail to you. Happy Christmas, friends. The Open Window by Saki. My aunt will be down presently, Mr. Nuttall, said a very self-possessed young lady of 15. In the meantime, you must try to put up with me. Frampton Nuttall endeavored to say the correct something which should duly flatter the niece of the moment, without unduly discounting the aunt that was to come. Privately, he doubted more than ever whether these formal visits on a succession of total strangers would do much towards helping the nerve cure which he was supposed to be undergoing. "I know how it will be," his sister had said when he was preparing to migrate to this rural retreat. "You will bury yourself down there and not speak to a living soul, and your nerves will be worse than ever from moping. I shall just give you letters of introduction to all the people I know there. Some of them, as far as I can remember, were quite nice." Frampton wondered whether Mrs. Sappleton, the lady to whom he was presenting one of the letters of introduction, came into the nice division. "Do you know many of the people around here?" asked the niece, when she had judged that they had had sufficient silent communion. "Hardly a soul," said Frampton. "My sister was staying here at the rectory, you know, some 4 years ago, and she gave me these letters of introduction to some of the people here." He made the last statement in a tone of distinct regret. "Then you know practically nothing about my aunt?" pursued the self-possessed young lady. "Only her name and address," admitted the caller. He was wondering whether Mrs. Sappleton was in the married or widowed state. An undefinable something about the room seemed to suggest masculine habitation. "Her great tragedy happened just 3 years ago," said the child. "That would have been since your sister's time." "Her tragedy?" asked Frampton. Somehow in this restful country spot, tragedy seemed out of place. "You may wonder why we keep that window wide open on an October afternoon," said the niece, indicating a large French window that opened onto a lawn. "It is quite warm for this time of year," said Frampton, "but what has that window got to do with anything but the tragedy?" "Out through that window, 3 years to a day, her husband and her two young brothers went off for the day shooting. They never came back. In crossing the moor to their favorite snipe shooting ground, they were all three engulfed in a treacherous piece of bog. It had been that dreadful wet summer, you know, and places that were safe in other years gave way suddenly without warning. Their bodies were never recovered. That was the dreadful part of it." Here the child's voice lost its self-possessed note and became falteringly human. "Poor auntie always thinks they'll come back some day, they and the little brown spaniel that was lost with them, and walk in at that window just as they used to. That is why the window is kept open every evening until it is quite dusk. Poor dear auntie, she has often told me how they went out, her husband with his white waterproof coat over his arm, and Ronnie, her youngest brother, singing, 'Bertie, where do you bound?' as he always did to tease her, because she said it got on her nerves. Do you know, sometimes on still quiet evenings like this, I always get this creepy feeling that they will all walk in through that window." She broke off with a little shudder. It was a relief to Frampton when the aunt bustled into the room with a whirl of apologies for being late and making her appearance. "I hope our Vera has been amusing you," she said. "She has been very interesting," said Frampton. "I hope you don't mind the open window," said Mrs. Sappleton briskly. "My husband and brothers will be home directly from shooting, and they always come in this way. They've been out for snipe in the marshes today, so they'll make a fine mess over my poor carpets. So like you menfolk, isn't it?" She rattled on cheerfully about shooting and scarcity of birds, and the prospects of duck in the winter. To Frampton, it was all purely horrible. He made a desperate but only partially successful effort to turn the talk onto a less ghastly topic. He was conscious that his hostess was giving him only a fragment of her attention, and that her eyes were constantly straying past him to the open window in the lawn below, beyond. It was certainly an unfortunate coincidence that he should have paid his visit on this, the most tragic of anniversaries. The doctors agree in ordering me complete rest, an absence of mental excitement, and an avoidance of anything in the nature of violent physical exercise, announced Frampton, who labored under the tolerably widespread delusion that total strangers and chance acquaintances are hungry for the least detail of one ailments and infirmaries, their cause and cure. "On the matter of diet, there are not so much in agreement," he continued. "No?" said Mrs. Sappleton, in a voice which only replaced a yawn at the last moment. Then she suddenly brightened in alert attention, but not to what Frampton was saying. "Here they are at last," she cried, "just in time for tea, and don't they look as if they were muddy up to the eyes?" Frampton shivered slightly and turned towards the niece with a look intended to convey sympathetic comprehension. The child was staring out through the open window with a dazed horror in her eyes. In a chill shock of nameless fear, Frampton swung round in his seat and looked in the same direction. In the deepening twilight, three figures were walking across the lawn towards the window. They all carried guns under their arms, and one of them was additionally burdened with a white coat hung over his shoulders. A tired brown spaniel kept close at their heels. Noisily, they neared the house, and then a hoarse young voice chanted out of the dusk, "I say, Bertie, what are you bound?" Frampton grabbed wildly at his walking stick and hat. The hall door, the gravel drive, and the front gate were dimly noted stages in his headlong retreat. A cyclist coming along the road had to run into the hedge to avoid imminent collision. "Here we are, my dear," said the bearer of the white mackintosh, coming through the window. "Fairly muddy, but most of it's dry. Who was that who bolted out as we came up?" "A most extraordinary man, a Mr. Nuttall," said Mrs. Sappleton. "Could only talk about his illnesses, and dashed off without a word of goodbye or apology when you arrived. One would have thought he'd seen a ghost." "I expect it was the spaniel," said the niece calmly. "He told me he had a horror of dogs. He was once hunted into a cemetery somewhere on the banks of the Ganges by a pack of pariah dogs, and had to spend the night in a newly dug grave with a creature snarling and grinning and foaming just above him, enough to make anyone lose their nerve." Romantic stories at short notice were her specialty.